The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 5. Loved by You. Eridan. Sing, search, sail. Sing, search, sail. All around him, aquatic life floated to the surface of the boiling sea. The atmosphere itself was being torn to shred by hundreds, thousands, countless meteors falling from the sky. He could barely breathe in the heat like he was inhaling fire. Eridan Ampora fought down a cough as he attempted to channel his innate magic, a song of enchantment. Heritage wailed. It was a charm used to lure sailors to their deaths on rocky shoals, and singing it as he did stretched the magic beyond its bounds, tearing at his very soul. But he had nothing else. Even the dinky fishing boat upon which he challenged the reins of fate was beginning to fail. So he called. A searing bolt took a chunk out of the railing on the bow. It had been hours, and the churning ocean had swelled what must have been hundreds of feet. The rocky outcropping he called his home had been swallowed whole. Feferi should have been somewhere. He left her on land. She couldn't have conceivably gotten deep enough to evade the sudden onslaught of heavenly fire. He cried out again, his throat raw with it. There was no more magic left. His ancestry abandoned him. Then, there under the frothing gray crest of a falling wave, something. A flash of red against white in the distance, only barely noticed by his hawkish vision. He hauled the wheel starboard, picking up a course dead on for the glimmer. A minute passes. His boat plowed through a school of fish floating together in death. Another minute. A meteor shrieked into the gulf a few miles off. He had to turn the prow into the sudden onslaught of waves so they didn't roll him, losing sight of his hope for a moment. He lost his course, turned around. The compass in his mind was going haywire, magnetic north and south spinning in circles around his head, and a glimpse of streaking fire appeared in the edge of his vision. His avian body reacted before his thinking mind did, dropping his arms from the wheel, launching him into the sky, and his mighty wings carrying him aloft on a gust of blood-hot air, just in time for him to watch his boat explode in a shower of splinters and sea spray. The sheer concussive force of the meteor strike took him from the sky, his long, elegant, gliding wings not agile enough to recover him before he plummeted into the ocean. It was boiling. Eridan screamed as he thrashed to the surface of the water with all six of his limbs, feeling the searing hot sea soak through his feathers and over his skin. Something outside of his vision clobbered his head from behind, and he latched onto it, desperately yanking himself out of the water. His savior was a blasted piece of the hull of his boat, still morosely bearing the name Via Dolorosa, painted in his hand. He felt all the skin across his body loosing itself from the underlying muscle. He looked around, looking for something, anything that could convey him to Feferi. His body couldn't. He felt the feathers sloughing off his wings in matted piles. His hands were a nauseating vermilion. He inhaled and let out one last croaking song. Drowned out in the roar of the ocean, only a trace of the magic whispered across the water. Something bumped into the wood. Something limp. Eridan turned his head and his gaze fell upon the dissolving body of his best and only friend. Her eyes were whited over. Not even the ocean could wash away the sheer volume of blood pouring from her wounded face in half-coagulated globs. The thing that once carried Feferi snapped its head to lock eyes with him, grinning a black and red smile. It croaked to him.
No money down on new and used Nissan Altimas. And when you test drive any car in our lot, you'll be able to
shot
win
up
a
in bed,
brand new
wings flapping wildly and knocking the lamp and alarm clock, which was spewing local radio, onto the bedroom floor. The alarm's batteries were knocked out, and the dealership commercial cut off abruptly. He slapped his hands to his face, his chest, his arms, finding all his beautiful flesh blessedly intact and cool, if clammy. The ever-present rain pittered its patter on the roof of his houseboat. He let out a sigh and a groan and a whine all in one, and rubbed his eyes as he swung his clawed legs to the side of the bed. This was the third fucking time this month he'd had that dream. It always started out like the memory of that day, the boat, the meteors, the searching. Then it would swirl itself around and get all kinds of out of sorts with pain, death, and in one memorable instance, forgetting to study for the meteor exam. Obviously, it didn't go any of those stupid ways. He found Feff on a rapidly sinking ferry wreckage over one of the sunken barrier islands, her hybrid form, her most vulnerable form, wounded and torn, and saved her. That's all that mattered. The humans on board were a drop in the bucket on the grand scale, and he couldn't save all of the possessions she toted around on her back. The water was simply coming too fast. As he pitifully gathered the fallen lamp, alarm, and batteries, and his senses awoke, he smelled something very literally fishy.
"Must be Friday," he thought regretfully.
Friday, as Feff liked to call it. That meant a busy day of assembling greasy plates for the needy hordes of bipedal apes that flocked to his friend's soup kitchen while she turned up an assemblage of produce they'd caught and received as donations into meals. Eridan stood the lamp back in its rightful place and somewhat spitefully smacked the freshly re-batteried radio down next to his phone, which buzzed indignantly. It was his phone buzzing, not the one next to it, Feff's, which she perennially failed to use or recharge. He'd gotten her the iPhone shortly after Radio Shack opened its doors to alternatives to alleviate their issue, mostly his issue, of having to share a phone. It didn't help. She still just used his whenever she felt the need to. He looked at the phone, tapping its home button to wake up the screen. Fucking hey, that was a lot of notifications. Probably Nep and Razzy flooding the chat with their unsanctioned RP. He sniffed and tossed the device back on the bedside table with a clack.
"Eridan! Are you up?"
Feferi called through the bedroom window, loud enough to wake him if he wasn't.
"Yeah,"
he exhaled.
"Potato duty?" "Sweet potatoes,"
she chirped in answer. His grumbles became partially insincere. Sweet potato fries were really good. He grabbed his apron off the hanger next to the door. It was a gag apron Sol had sent him after Eridan had vented to the demon about his disagreeable cooking skills, reading Kiss the Cock and emblazoned with a dressed-up rotisserie chicken. Feff had found it obscene and filled in the second C with a blue Sharpie to more traditionally spell Kiss the Cook.
"Where's my knife?"
he asked, walking into the main room of the houseboat in which the kitchenette existed. Feff had hauled a second stove into the boat, which Eridan had to figure out how to connect to their gas line without blowing the vessel sky high. So far it was working pretty fucking good, if he did say so himself.
"I do believe it's dirty."
She gestured to the sink full of suds without turning around from the fish she was processing.
"Can't you cut stuff with a normal knife?"
she asked pleadingly. "Not a chance in Hades." He retrieved his fillet knife from the bottom of the sink and washed it off. Feff gave him a sidelong glance, her eyes glittering a dubious emerald.
"One of these days I'm going to get you a full knife set as a gift, and then you'll have to use a different one."
She pointed a fish head still attached to the spine at him threateningly.
"Why?"
"Because I'll feel bad, Eridan," she dramatically said along with him, giggling as she tossed a potato at him from the bag on the counter. He stabbed it out of the air, catching it on the end of his knife. He retrieved the canvas sack and sat down at the dining table, which already had a clean cutting board on it, and got to work. Sweet potatoes were easier to cut than russets, thankfully. They stuck less to his knife as he turned them into long prisms of orange root.
"Any word from your mum today?"
he asked, tossing a foul-looking tuber into the compost bin. Feff sighed.
"Kind of. I definitely heard her while I was in the water, but I think she was just singing and it happened to reach me."
She scraped fish guts on top of the peels.
"I want to try and get out of the gulf at some point. I'm worried the seafloor elevation and all the human debris is, like, jamming the signal. Do you know what I'm trying to say?"
Eridan hummed an affirmation. The silence hung for a moment before he spoke up.
"I really am sorry."
"Would you knock it off?"
Pfeff interrupted, as though she was ready for it. She turned to him with frustration, hands on her hips. A scary notion, given the knife in her hand.
It's been years now, Ayrton. You can't keep apologizing for saving my life.
It was true, they'd had this conversation about 1,000 times. He still felt guilty he'd severed her ability to communicate with her mom when he saved her, especially given the dream he'd woken up with. His eyes lingered on the scar lining her cheek.
I wish you hadn't been in that situation in the first place, he began. Those humans, not a single one even tried to help you.
He chopped a potato lengthwise forcefully.
They hardly deserve all the kindness you're still showing them.
Feferi carried the pile of fillets on her cutting board as she walked to the table. She added it to the already half-full huge bowl of fish. Ayrton tried to avoid it, but Pfeff caught his gaze.
It's not about deserving. It's about helping anyone who needs it. Even the worst people in the world deserve that kindness, Ayrton.
He scoffed in response and tucked a stray hair behind his ear.
They sure haven't fucking shown it to us, or our environments. You know how much I used to think they were all just a bunch of big, horrible polluters.
Ayrton briefly smiled at his memories of the pair of them sabotaging trawling nets, oil rigs, and the occasional fishing boat.
But you just need to get to know them, individually. They're all just as much of individuals as we are,
she finished. He was pouting. Pfeff threw her hands up and walked back to the cutting board.
I'm not going to spend my time trying to convince you that you should care about other people, Ayrton. Come around or don't.
The sound of fish scales ripping and the steady thunk of the knife chopping filled the cabin. The sea breeze carried in a squall of gull cries. The tide gently rocked their house, waves sloshing above sunken streets. A fat gulf grouper swam through the remains of a Waffle House below. Ayrton quietly continued chopping fries.
Just feels unfair sometimes. We call the alternative like some kind of second option when we've been here the old fucking time. Some of us are born to eat them, and they're at the top of the food chain. Right now their government is deciding if we deserve to be equal. Like they couldn't even conceive that we could be better.
He chomped half of a raw fry in frustration, immediately spitting it into the compost in disgust. Pfeff snorted.
Well, we aren't feeding the government, are we?
Ayrton stared at his warped reflection in the large silvery bowl the fish was sitting in. The streak of bottle purple that was starting to show roots in his hair, the glasses he'd started needing a year ago, all made by humans. He sighed. He threw the rest of the bitten raw fry in his mouth as atonement for the hypocrisy. Ayrton wiped his hands off with a kitchen rag. Whistling to Video Killed the Radio Star, which had come on the local station and still could be heard from outside the boat as they wrapped up the breakfast shift. He had seen a few alts in line today, looking grateful for the kindness shown not just by Pfeff this time, but himself. It did feel good to be able to help his people for once. Maybe word would spread and they'd start seeing more familiar species around the kitchen. He stepped into the bedroom and removed his apron, putting his hands on his back and cracking it loudly. The phone buzzed at him from the nightstand accusingly. He rolled his eyes, walked over, and grabbed it. Time to scroll to the bottom of the spam wall. The light of the screen glinted off his smudged glasses. Astonishment landed squarely on his features. It was chased off by disbelief. Concern encroached on the territory. Then the whole place was wiped clean by thrill. He scrambled to the door, phone in hand.
Pfeff, she's alive!
May 3rd, 3 o'clock p.m. AC.
Yeah. Lionstar saunters into the group chat with a smug expression on her handsomely whiskered face.
AC.
Yeah. She looks around at the assembled friends and opens her maw in a mighty roar. Sure all that her clanmates are listening with rapt attention, she speaks.
AC.
Yeah. Let all cats old enough to catch their own prey gather here beneath the high rock for a clan meeting.
AC.
Yep. First order of business, my loyal deputy Greypelt is all settled into the leader's den. I thank the mighty Crabclaw for his help in teaching Greypelt about the treaty with two leggers.
AC.
Yep. I also thank the lovely Firescale for her presence.
CT.
Nepeta, cease this foolishness at once.
CT.
It does not behoove you. Nobody will know what the fiddlesticks you are talking about.
AC.
No. Oh, you're no fun. I just wanted to let everyone know that you are all moved in with a little help from Carkitty and Perezzi.
CT.
Yes, it was very nice of them to help, and I appreciated the assistance.
AC.
No. Oh, there is something else. I wanted to remind everyone that we are going to have a welcome party to get us all together, which will be 3 days after the full moon, for obvious reasons.
CT.
I look forward to seeing you all in person.
May 3rd, 3:30 p.m. AA.
Selfie.jpg. Selfie description. Aradia is standing in her living room, giving her patented uncanny valley grin to the camera. Her bejeweled front teeth glinting in the light. She is partly translucent. Through her, the camera also captures Salix and Tavros, both holding Wii remotes. The TV screen displays a Pokemon game. Tavros is wearing a gray-knit, virgin-killer sweater. The large open back exposing his wings.
AA.
Can we bring our new housemate?
AA.
His name is Tavros. He's an old friend of mine.
AC.
Yeah. Sounds perfect. The more the merrier.
AC.
No. GA, don't forget to bring Rose. It's about time all your closest friends got to really meet this maid of yours.
GA.
I will consider it. Rose's friend John has just arrived. Were she anyone else, I would presume that his presence would preoccupy her, but it seems Dave is occupying most of his time.
GA.
In other news, I believe John met Equius while driving to town.
GA.
In other news, Aunt AA must bring this Tavros to me promptly. That sweater is an atrocity.
AA.
Virginkiller.jpg. Image description. A candid photo of Tavros focusing on his torso. The sweater shows off his musculature and wings, the light gray wool pale against his deep brown complexion. His wings, massive and gauzy, sprout from his back and bracket his spine. Like a butterfly, he has both an upper and lower wing. The upper wing emerges from just below the curve of his shoulder blade, the joint perhaps the length of a palm. The lower wing is just barely separated from the upper, the connection point of similar size.
AA.
Good luck.
May 3rd, 4:45 p.m. TC.
Oh shit, I think a shared miracle is upon us.
TC.
That's my magic mirror, buddy.
T.C.
We used to write slam poetry together.
T.C.
Until the mirror broke.
May 3rd, 5:30 p.m. G.C.
We are still coming.
G.C.
However.
G.C.
Karkles is having another freakout.
G.C.
No?
G.C.
Solik sent a snippet from a conversation Karkles had with Frischika.
GC.
Just a few weeks before 4:13.
AC.
No. Poor Vriskers. And Carkitty.
May 4th, 5:45 a.m. CG.
Holy fucking!
CG.
I can't believe!
CG.
Fuck's sake, it's Vriska!
May 4th, 6 o'clock a.m. GC.
Yikes, nightmare?
GC.
I'm coming down there.
May 4th, 7:45 a.m. CG.
First off, I did not have a freakout. Rational, level-headed community leaders do not have freakouts.
CG.
Second off, that was not a nightmare.
CG.
Vriska fell in my fucking river this morning.
CG.
She looks like pure and utter shit, but it's her.
CG.
I had to give her CPR. She couldn't swim for shit.
CG.
Apparently rain isn't the only running water that can hurt her.
CG.
She's an honest-to-goats desert vampire. The bitch never thought to mention it.
CG.
When I emptied her lungs, the water was stained silver. Her fucking lungs were bleeding.
CG.
Her blood actually turns to fucking mercury.
CG.
And now she won't wake up.
I can't tell if it's exhaustion, if it's the river water affecting her, or if it's her injuries, her leg.
GC.
The foot is on backwards.
CG.
Yeah, that.
May 4th, 8:15 a.m. CG.
After various attempts to wake her, we think she needs blood.
GC.
But we don't know if ours is human enough.
GC.
Or if she will be able to stop.
CG.
Usually I would assume you just have no faith in her.
CG.
But yeah, she's so fucked up looking, she probably would just drain us.
CG.
I think we need to break into the emergency stock Mama Grub keeps on hand.
CG.
At GA, can you ditch breakfast?
GA's phone is set to do not disturb. CG.
Fuck.
Rose. Rose did not wake up this morning and decide to get in a fight with her girlfriend. Yesterday, once Rose had walked Kanaya home and exchanged pleasantries with Mama Grub, she had stopped thinking about her entirely. Instead, she had snuck into her own home, dodged unpleasantries with her own mother, and broken into the woman's office. She had spent the entire night looking through Dr. Lalonde's records regarding a variety of topics, at least the ones that were erroneously left open. The foremost ones she was interested in were her mother's top-secret research on magic, and her even more top-secret research on magical subject J.H., which Rose knew to be the initials of her missing friend Jade. It felt perverse the first time she discovered her friend's medical records, but Rose was now numb to the violation after thousands of hours learning everything the 19-year-old had hidden from her. The records of J.H. also contained a battery of tests on various extra-human abilities, including one of ancient artifacts. Rose hoped against hope that Ogham's summoning circles would be among the tests. Unfortunately, she had come up empty. But now it was morning. Rose was shaky from minimal sleep, had missed her breakfast date with Kanaya in order to continue her research, and could feel malcontent brewing in the air. She could keep researching, double down on her ignorance, and hope Kanaya's temper cooled, or she could wipe off yesterday's makeup, buy some flowers, and do her best to charm her way back into her girlfriend's good graces. The eyeliner came off in sticky black clumps. With a dark sigh, she picked up her two journals, one for Jade, one for Magic, and exited the large office, leaving the old PC and the rows of filing cabinets behind. A glance out the window told her that the rain, which had ceased sometime during the night, was back. The water looked refreshing. Perhaps a shower was in order. A quick rinse and a change of clothes later, Rose was ready. On her way out the door, she spotted the dregs of a martini left on the kitchen counter, dregs being a toothpick and a perfectly empty glass. Her lip curled in derision. The glass wasn't there last night. And there was a small mirror next to the front door, ensconced in the arms of a wizard statuette. Rose gave herself a once-over, adjusting the lavender blouse Kanaya had custom-made for her, hoping the gesture would be endearing, not desperate. Paired with a black skirt and a gold headband, it looked date-appropriate and hopefully would convince Kanaya to turn breakfast into brunch. She exited the penthouse suite, keys in one hand, black umbrella in the other, and headed for the elevator. Once inside, she pulled her phone from her jacket pocket, making sure the portable charger was plugged in securely. With her phone dead, Rose couldn't be sure where Kanaya was. There was a path she could trace past a flower shop, the cafe for the date, and then to Kanaya's home if she was not at the cafe. Rose began her trek. Rose reached the front door of the seamstress shop that dominated the first floor of the Grubb family home. Kanaya had not been at the cafe, somewhat unsurprisingly. Rose took the opportunity to purchase some caffeine, which she'd sucked down and disposed of on the way over. The flowers were slightly damp. The rain was less of a downpour than earlier in the week, but still a worthy foe for her umbrella. Rose settled her nerves, willing a cool sense of calm to wash over her. She knew that as long as she remained level-headed, everything would be fine. She opened the door to the shop, stepping inside and closing her umbrella. A customer was occupying Kanaya's mother. Mama Grubb, née Virginia Grubb, was a veritable rock. Every alternative person in the greater Houston area seemed to know the seamstress, and she, in turn, seemed to know the name of anyone that walked, skittered, or slithered through the glass door. Mama nodded at the customer, a burly middle-aged man with prominent sideburns, as he described modifications for a piece of clothing on the table that looked much too large for him.
Werewolf, Rose thought.
The man said something in a flirtatious tone, and Mama played it off with a coy smile and comment about her age. There was no reason the man would be acting insincerely, though. Mama was a beautiful woman. Her eyes were a warm hazel, set like gems among the wrinkles of a life lived smiling. Her nose was a sharp, straight ramp that led you right to them. She moved with poise and grace. Like in another life, she was a dancer, and despite her occupation, her shoulders were only just beginning to turn inwards. Rose could only dream to one day wear the years so proudly. Mama saw Rose and looked as though she wanted to go and speak with her. Through a combination of the customer's presence and Rose's evasive maneuvering, she managed to make enough politely deferential gestures to excuse herself up the stairs to the attached apartment without getting caught in any awkward conversation while Kanaya was upset with her. With Miss Grubb's acknowledgement, Rose ascended the stair to the locked door, then smoothed down her blouse, shook the damp from the flowers, and knocked. Almost simultaneously, the door was yanked open, and Rose was startled by the force of it. Kanaya was standing inside the door, a lunchbox, for some bizarre reason, in her hand. She did not look happy. "Beloved, I am..." Rose only spoke a few words before Kanaya cut her off sharply. "Come inside, now. You are late," the girl spoke sharply, completely ignoring the flowers as she gestured at Rose to step inside. Kanaya quickly shut the door behind her, then strode towards the kitchen, placing the lunchbox on the counter and maneuvering herself to stand behind it, the granite serving as a barrier between them. Rose presented the flowers a second time, the bright orange and red blossoms a fragrant display. "Kanaya, my dear, words do not express the contrition I feel for my tardiness. I was engaged in a spot of research last night, and, well, time got away from me a bit, but late breakfast is just early brunch, yes?" Inexplicably, Kanaya scowled at this and once again ignored the flowers, drumming her fingers on the counter. Rose noted the phone near Kanaya's hand and continued.
"My phone. I forgot to charge it, or I would have texted you, you know that, but really I'm not that late."
Kanaya's eyes tightened, and she picked up the phone, displaying the clock accusingly.
"An hour?"
She took a breath. "And a half. That is late. That is significantly late. And you were late due to..." And here she paused, making air quote motions.
"Doing a spot of research. Last night."
Kanaya looked accusingly at her. Rose felt the heavy weight of the bags under her eyes.
"Well, perhaps more of a blotch than a spot," Rose allowed. "But I promise its importance cannot be overstated."
Kanaya rubbed at one temple, making a pained expression.
"Rose, this is the fourth time you've been late or not shown up at all to one of our dates. Most people operate on the rule of three."
She crossed her arms, apparently having already made up her mind on how she was going to proceed with this argument.
"I'm not unreasonable. I have indulged your borderline fetishistic obsession with magic for this long."
Rose stared at that. Indulged? Kanaya had not said anything in protest of her research. She continued, lost in her own tirade, ignorant of Rose's obviously growing reproach.
"It would have been fine if you told me you would be late, or even if you cancelled. But do you know how awful being stood up feels? How embarrassing? The waiter offered me a pastry. On the house! Well, heavens forbid you get a free scone," Rose snapped back. "This is my work, and you know quite well why I'm doing it. Some leniency with my search,"
Kanaya interrupted her with a scoff.
"Work? You really want to claim this infatuation of yours is work? You aren't acting like an academic. Your behavior is fanatical. You act like everyone else is a servant to your whims.
Kanaya uncrossed her arms so she could express her frustration somatically. Rose took a breath. She felt herself losing her cool sense of calm, bubbles of discontent beginning to simmer.
I would appreciate it if we could discuss this, Rose said plainly, trying to turn this around before it spiraled, like adults. As I was saying, I would appreciate some leniency with my search, considering the magnitude of the task at hand and the potential of its implications.
I won't have you misconstrue the necessities of the pursuit for something previously believed to be mythical by the entire history of human scientists to be illogical in a fit of hysteria, however justified it feels.
It was true that Rose had taken some leaps and fallen flat in her research, but it wasn't like there was a wealth of historical knowledge to rely upon. She needed to track down primary sources if she ever hoped to make any progress.
By all means, let us discuss this like adults. Do you really mean to call me illogical and hysterical after all the benders you've dragged me on just to make zero progress on this task of yours?
Kanaya asked. Rose struggled to keep her face calm, to think up the next step of de-escalation she should attempt. Kanaya took the initiative before Rose could respond.
Have you forgotten them? Like your phone? I have hauled your smoldering trash on looting expeditions. I have smoothed over every near-miss fight you've instigated with your invasive questioning of alternatives. I even let you afflict my friends for the chance you get something from it, and I can't even count on you for a breakfast date?
She shook her head as though baffled.
Hysteria? Are you going to accuse me of wandering womb next?
Rose's left eye twitched. Kanaya was deflecting. She was trying to cover for her true feelings by blaming the research, blaming Rose's lateness. Rose knew what was really going on. She simply needed to apply her knowledge of psychology.
You are clearly upset over something you don't want to state plainly, Rose identified.
It is not my scholarly pursuit of the arcane that has you so worked up. She angled her gaze inquisitively. If she could just get Kanaya to see reason, logic always prevails.
Nor is it the breakfast.
Though I'm sorry I was late. An apology for a simple mistake, it ought to be enough. This was something that Kanaya had clearly been harboring some ill will towards. Rose knew what it was, or rather, who.
It's Jade, same as always. I could never talk to you about her because you would pout and demur. You think I'm infatuated with her. You called me fetishistic, ergo, your subconscious is obsessing over the amorous.
It was so obvious. Rose knew Kanaya, and had felt resentment growing in her.
My research is to gather the abilities necessary to find my friend, and you need to get over this childish notion that it is anything other than platonic care for her that drives me.
Kanaya's eyes bulged. Her jaw clenched.
You!
She threw her hands down at her sides in fists and stomped.
You are literally collecting supposedly magical fetishes. You are being so dense. Impossible.
Her voice raised, her cheeks flushing.
You are cherry-picking my words, trying to psychoanalyze me, and bringing your internet friend, who you have seen neither hide nor hair of for 3 years, into this.
Her voice began to crack.
You have not been treating me well, Rose.
Of course I'm bringing her into this. She's at the heart of this. She's the reason why I'm doing this research, and to pretend she isn't is proof of your jealousy.
To just call her an internet friend, as if you and I didn't start as internet friends. You're trying to minimize her.
Rose was starting to get livid. Kanaya was being irrational. Why couldn't she see that?
Kanaya jabbed a finger at her. You've been trying to get your hands on magic since before the meteor's finished falling. If you actually cared fuck all about your friend or her memory, you would be scouring the ocean between here and that island for a battered corpse.
Kanaya's lips curled back as she said this with a snarl. Rose reeled back in shock, the pure hypocrisy.
Jade is special.
There was no more coolness in Rose's reserves, just fire.
A girl doesn't get tested and trained by a lab like some sort of superhero if she isn't. There's no way she's dead. She is out there somewhere, just waiting for me to find her. I can't give up.
Jade wouldn't give up on her.
You're not just jealous about how much I care. You're covering for your own bullshit. Your internet friend, that vampire girl, you know she's dead. Or at least that's what you tell yourself, but you should be looking for her, putting in the effort, not whining at me for doing everything I can for my missing friend.
Part of Rose, far removed from the scene, felt she was going too far, but Kanaya had struck first. She brought death into it. Kanaya took in a short breath, the small girl drawing her chest up. Her lips were pursed, and her features were suddenly stricken with a deathly stillness. There was a cold victory in her eyes. Maybe I did. Think she was dead. Clearly she wasn't as special as Jade. Just like the billions and billions of other people with families, lovers, friends. Gone with the meteors. But my friend is missing no longer. And I'm going to do all I can to help her in a real way. Rather than using her as a justification, instead of wasting my time on your batshit fantasies. She walked to the door, bringing the lunchbox with her. You can see yourself out. Rose could only stare in shock as the door closed behind Kanaya, flowers still in hand. This, the turn of events, simply didn't make sense. Everything had gone horribly wrong. Kanaya. Kanaya stumbled down the stairs two at a time, a white-knuckle grip on the bulky lunchbox as she tried to focus. Rage choked her, a call to turn around and storm back up there to escalate things further. Instead, she darted into one of the workrooms, grabbing a large black cloak with a magically reinforced waterproof lining, slinging it over her arm. Stepping into the main shop space, she caught her mom's attention for a moment, pausing the conversation with a customer. Mom, I need to go see Carcat. Can I take the car? She must have read the turmoil in her daughter's eyes because her mom's face was full of compassion and understanding as she replied. Of course. Call me if you need anything. I'll check on our guest after I finish up here. She looked pensively at Kanaya for a moment. I love you, honey. The keys are by the door. Drive safe. The love of her mother, warm and unconditional, made Kanaya feel a little better. Thank you. I love you too. With that, Kanaya strode out the back door, ignoring the rain as she approached the family car and gently placed the lunchbox full of blood inside. It was stacked next to two more lunchboxes in the passenger seat, and the floor space was occupied by a cooler. Rose had caught her on her way out with the last of the blood. Hopefully it would be enough. The cloak was carefully placed on top of the boxes, then Kanaya got inside the car. Only once she'd driven a few blocks away from her home did the angry tears start to fall down her face. She began navigating the streets towards Carcat's bridge and turned the conversation, no, the fight, over in her mind. Words said in rage, truth being trampled beneath miscommunication, better ways to say the things she did flickering in and out of her thoughts like hummingbirds. How could Rose be so damned delusional? It was so very clear that Jade was not the real reason for Rose's increasingly erratic behavior. No, Jade was just an excuse, and a flimsy one at that, for an obsession bordering on the addictive. Rose had a problem, a real problem, and it physically hurt Kanaya to watch her spiraling further. At first, the two had been in uncertainty and diminished hope and the darkness of mourning together. At first, it had seemed like a way for Rose to grapple with her grief, a way to cope with the fact that she would likely never have a body to bury for Jade, just as Kanaya lacked a body for Vriska. But the more library dates they went on, the more anecdotes Kanaya was finally able to tell about her less-than-normal childhood, the more encounters with Gamzee and the more discussions about Vriska, it was clear that Rose was not going through the process of grief with Kanaya. She had grasped firmly on to denial, used rage only to fuel her, took one look at bargaining, and decided to put a new and horrible spin on it. While Kanaya joined a weekly meeting for local teens to talk about those they lost, Rose started getting more secretive. Rather than focus on those that were around her, rather than try to bridge the gap with her mother, Rose began breaking into her mother's office to find the magical research hidden within. Discovering that subject J.H. referred to Jade, that had been the turning point. Rose would scour the rubble of university buildings, of old homes, of any place she felt might hide the secret wisdom,
She started getting angry when Kanaya talked about the little magic in her life, the secret knotwork her mother's family had used to add charms to the trim of garments for alternatives. Rose had ranted to Kanaya about how she wanted Dave to be as furious as his brother, the Hunter of Houston, as she was at her own mother, for hiding his occupation from him. She demanded to meet Kanaya's demon friend, attempted to badger Solix into making a deal, and accused him of being a liar when he admitted he could not teach Rose magic, that his own magic did not work like that. Rose lost sleep. She skipped meals. She dragged Kanaya to strange places so they could photograph carvings in stone and to draw sigils in chalk. It was hard to have a normal afternoon together before Rose would get twitchy and reach for the research journals. It was scary how Rose's whole world had narrowed. The blaring of a horn jerked Kanaya out of her thoughts, and she jammed the brakes just in time. The car briefly hydroplaned, fishtailing for a horrifying second before jerking to a stop. She was at the final intersection before the bridge, and the red light had gone unnoticed. Cars in the intersection honked as they passed. She shuddered, imagining what the car would look like if she crashed. Blood would be everywhere, not all of it hers. A horror flick bloodbath for the first responders, but Kanaya was fine. She reacted in time. She wiped the tears that blurred her vision away with her sleeve, sniffing a stifled sob back down into her stomach. Her friends needed her put together, not another mess. The light turned green, and she headed for the bridge, turning off the road into a parking area near the path to Carcat's home. She parked, exited the vehicle, and stepped around to the passenger side. The rain was slowing to a drizzle, making her lack of a raincoat a little less uncomfortable. A drawstring gym bag with a clean change of clothes was under the seat, and she grabbed that, recalling Carcat's description of river water stained silver with blood. She shoved her arms through the straps of the bag, wearing it like a backpack. She then reached back inside the car, grabbing a lunchbox.
"Took you long enough."
The scratchy voice of Terezi made Kanaya jerk in surprise, nearly dropping the lunchbox. The dragon was standing right behind her, fiddling with her cane and grinning nervously. Kanaya shoved the lunchbox handle into her friend's free hand.
"I'm here now. I brought as much blood as we had. About 3 gallons between the cooler and the lunchboxes. If you take one lunchbox and the rain cloak, I can stack the other two on top of the cooler."
As she spoke, Kanaya reached back inside the car, pulling the cloak out and passing it to Terezi, who shoved it under her arm.
"Sounds good. Let's hurry up. Carcat looked ready to open a vein himself."
Terezi frowned, then made a show of sniffing the air.
"Your aura is so full of crushed grapes right now that I could make wine from it. You must be infuriated."
Kanaya grimaced at this, electing to ignore it in favor of stacking the cooler and lunchboxes on the ground, locking the car, and picking up her burden of blood.
"How about we get down to Carcat before he does something drastic?" she spoke curtly, stepping past Terezi and lugging the blood down the dirt path to the underside of the bridge.
Terezi huffed and followed after her. In the shadows, Carcat was pacing next to a lump on the ground, covered by a plastic tarp. Christ, did these hooligans not keep blankets around? Kanaya walked up to the lump and seemed to startle Carcat out of his fugue.
"Kanaya, thank the goats you're here. Why did it take so long? This is a fucking miracle. I thought you'd be a little more hasty. I mean, for—"
He abruptly halted his tirade, seeing something in her posture and expression that he didn't need an aura sense to detect.
"Are you—"
A balled-up rain cloak slapped in his face, lobbed with some force from the underhand by Terezi. It sent Carcat staggering a few steps back and splashing into the river. Kanaya was grateful for it. She went to her knees and started pulling blood from the lunchbox. If the smell didn't wake her, Kanaya wasn't sure what would. She twisted the cap on the bag and a sharp iron smell suddenly filled the air. Terezi, who had kneeled down opposite her across the lump, stuck her tongue out at the pungent aroma. Kanaya didn't mind it. There was something nostalgic, romantic even, about the smell. Cuts and scratches from a playful childhood. She heard Carcat cursing as he pulled himself out of the river. She headed for the edge of the tarp. She reached for the edge of the tarp, which she now realized was double-layered in that rainbow-striped duct tape one could find at the Dawa store, and smelled potently of cherry perfume, she inquired with Terezi with a cocked eyebrow.
It blocks out auras when I'm sleeping in the van, she said with a shrug. Kanaya gave the tacky display a dubious look, double-checked that they were sufficiently guarded from the rain by the bridge, then pulled the tarp back enough to reveal Vriska's face. Despite the warning about her condition, Kanaya couldn't help a gasp of shock. The last time Kanaya had seen Vriska was a group gripe call. Carcat's less than original video service hosted on the alternate. The girl had been 14, with dark, glossy hair that reached her shoulders, and tawny skin that flushed warmly with fresh blood. She had smiled at her own jokes, flashing her teeth between bright lips. Her cheeks had been round and full. Now her hair hung limply, a ratty mess of uneven chunks. The warmth of someone else's blood was gone, revealing an uncanny coolness, a nearly bluish tint to her dusky skin. Her lips were dull, dry, and cracked, with a silvery stain that made her heart lurch to see. Her cheeks were gaunt, hollowed out, as were the dark shadows beneath her eyes and the flesh of her neck and collarbone. Her left arm resting atop the tarp was covered in blue-black scabby lacerations, a chunk of glass visibly embedded in a silver-stained wound sealing around it. But the worst was half-hidden beneath the hair. The left side of her temple was a mass of burn scars, the skin rippled and discolored, a raw shininess to it that dripped down the side of her face. Kanaya was terrified. She had never seen a vampire so discolored, neither with the unnatural blue blood that signified starvation, nor the quicksilver stain of a brush with her natural weakness. Frankly, she had never seen any type of person so injured. She took off the drawstring bag and gestured at her friends. Carcat, Terezi, we need to prop her up. If she tries to drink anything laying down, we don't want her choking. Help me out. The three teens together lifted Vriska gently, using the bag full of clothes as a cushion to prop her up. She was so light. It was like moving around a thick blanket. Vriska stirred just barely at the movement, head lolling in the direction of the blood bag. Kanaya grabbed it, quickly lifting the nozzle to the girl's dry, cracked lips and raising her chin. Kanaya started pouring slowly, but Vriska was guzzling it down, panting when the bag ran dry. Kanaya fed her bag after bag from the lunchbox, Carcat and Terezi watching pensively. She heard stone grating against stone as Carcat chewed on his thumb. She turned to reach for another bag, but the lunchbox was empty. She gestured for Terezi to open the cooler with her free hand, still propping up Vriska's head with the other. Terezi opened the cooler with a pop, grabbing the topmost bag. As Kanaya reached out for it, she felt something sharp in her wrist. A flash of a deep, stabbing pain numbed before she could register the hurt. She turned to jerk the arm away from Vriska, but it was held in a desperate, bony vice grip. Vriska was up, hunching over her arm like a gargoyle, fangs sunk deep in her artery. Kanaya felt the numbness spreading up her arm with each pounding beat of her heart. She cried out for the vampire to stop, but there was a crazed desperation in her poison yellow eyes, her whole body shaking. The creature that was Vriska's body, one honed on survival alone, snarled as it did all it could to keep itself alive. Kanaya looked at her and suddenly understood that Vriska's mind was not even present. Kanaya heard Carcat shout from behind her and then saw a flash of red and white as Terezi's cane came down over the vampire's head. The cane was a fold-out, and so all it really did was bend at its intended joint and deliver a reprimanding sting onto the girl's crown, but it was enough. The act spurred Kanaya out of shock and into a well-practiced maneuver, driving her palm forward into Vriska's sternum. Vriska gasped for air and fell onto her back, blood covering her palate. Her eyes darted wildly, her chest heaved. Kanaya crawled back likewise, clutching her wrist, and felt Carcat's stony arms lift her up from behind. The troll stood in front of her protectively, his reproachful shouting aimed not at Vriska, but at Terezi.
"What the hell was that? She was eating her!"
Terezi yelled defensively, putting her cane back together and holding it up like a baseball bat. The vampire, Vriska, was not looking at either of them, her blank yellow eyes focused on the bloody wrist Kanaya clutched to her chest. It didn't hurt, and the blood seemed to be coagulated as soon as the fangs pulled out, though the feeling had not yet returned. Kanaya saw Vriska's gaze move from her wrist to her neck, then settle on her face. There was recognition in her eyes, a distant memory drawn painstakingly to the surface.
Gah!
The noise that came out of Vriska's mouth could hardly be called a voice. It was miles of caked desert dust. It was clotted scabs between her teeth. It was dry air and hot sun and pain. She hacked and wheezed. She fell forward onto her hands and spat up a red-black smear that stained the concrete. She looked up at them, noticing now not only Kanaya, but also Karkat standing protectively, Terezi leaning forward in concern.
Kanaya,
was the name that barely squeaked out of her. Kanaya saw crimson pooling at the corners of Riska's eyes. Kanaya carefully stepped around Karkat, brushing aside the concerned hand he reached out to stop her. She let go of her wrist, the feeling starting to come back in pins and needles. Riska stared at the wound, realizing...
Wait, don't, Sam,
she stuttered as Kanaya approached. Kanaya kneeled down. She looked at her friend. Her eyes were no longer yellow. Instead, they were a stormy blue. The color bordered black, like the ocean reflecting thunderclouds. This was a friend, she remembered. Kanaya threw her arms around Vriska. Karkat made a muted noise that sounded like the start of a shout as Kanaya pulled the girl's fangs right in range of her jugular, but Vriska just froze. She felt like skin on bone, rigid like she'd been calcified. Vriska began shuddering, but Kanaya just held on, as though she could somehow heal the wounds and weariness through will alone. It was only when she felt a warm wetness on her shoulder did she realize what the shuddering was. Sobbing. Her own just-taken blood was pouring out from Vriska's eyes in unending rivulets, as the poor girl let out wheezing cry after cry. Crows were startled from a nearby bare tree. Kanaya felt another arm around her back and Vriska's as Karkat encircled the two of them, wordlessly murmuring something comforting and apologetic. Vriska took a stagger-stopped breath before continuing to wail. Something small and scaly slithered up between her and Kanaya's torso. A colorful little dragon that didn't want to miss out. Vriska's arms wrapped around Terezi like a stuffed animal, and the wizard made a squeak as she was squeezed tight. The four of them hugged and cried and reunited. Aqueous. Aqueous had slept in, a novel experience. He had also slept laying down on a special mattress designed to support his upper body softly while leaving a cutout portion for his lower half to rest on the firm floor. He had protested at the bed, telling Nepeta he was just fine sleeping standing up, but she had insisted. She had also insisted on cuddling him, curling up on the mattress and snuggling against him. Now that he was awake, he was trying to quietly disentangle himself from her without the werecougar stirring. She looked too peaceful. It wouldn't be right to disturb her. However, his phone had been buzzing quite annoyingly from the table on the other side of his room, and he was starting to wonder if one of their friends was up to something, or worse, that his father was calling to check in. Arthur was incredibly understanding, letting Aqueous shirk his primary responsibilities to come here, but he still expected Aqueous to do his duty to the clan in a roundabout way. So Aqueous gently removed his partner's arm, sliding away from her and standing up, grateful for the carpet muffling his hoofsteps as he walked across the room. Aqueous's phone was bombarded with messages, and he began to briskly skim them as he scrolled through. There were a lot of welcome, well, clam in one case, direct texts from the others, but the majority of messages appeared to stem from the group chat. As he read, he felt the hairs on his neck stand up.
May 4th, 8:15 a.m. Gray Karkat Troll.
After various attempts to wake her, we think she needs blood.
McCoy Terezi Dragon.
But we don't know if ours is human enough.
McCoy Terezi Dragon.
Or if she will be able to stop.
Gray Cockat Troll.
Usually I would assume you just have no faith in her.
Gray Cockat Troll.
But yeah, she's so fucked up looking, she probably would just drain us.
Gray Cockat Troll.
I think we need to break into the emergency stock Mama Grub keeps on hand.
Gray Cockat Troll.
At Grub Kanaya Human, can you ditch breakfast?
Grub Kanaya Human's phone is set to do not disturb. Gray Cockat Troll.
Fuck.
May 4th, 8:20 a.m. Empora Aridin Siren.
What the fuck?
Empora Aridin Siren.
This is alive?
Empora Aridin Siren.
We're almost done cleaning up. We can be there soon.
Gray Cockat Troll.
Not until we get some blood in her feather brains.
Gray Cockat Troll.
You'd be better off getting in touch with the grubs.
Empora Aridin Siren.
I could always find a vagrant for her to drain.
Empora Aridin Siren.
Hey, no the shall not for fairy.
Gray Cockat Troll.
On second thought, why don't you both stay put for now?
Gray Cockat Troll.
I don't want Aridin kidnapping some guy you literally just fed.
Empora Aridin Siren.
Come on, guys, we're just joking, mostly.
Empora Aridin Siren.
Oh, Fef just hit me.
Empora Aridin Siren.
Now she's taking my phone to...
Empora Aridin Siren.
With a pillow. It was a necessary reprimand for Fairy.
May 4th, 8:30 a.m. Grub Kanaya Human.
Apologize for the delay.
Grub Kanaya Human.
My date is an hour late.
Grub Kanaya Human.
I shall return home and retrieve the blood, which is ethically sourced and does not require murdering the homeless.
Grub Kanaya Human.
At Gray Carcat Troll, is she covered? Gray Carcat Troll. Yes, we have her under my bridge. She's out of the rain.
Grub Kanaya Human.
Good, I will also bring a rain cloak.
Grub Kanaya Human.
And dry clothes.
McCoy Terezi Dragon.
Bring every blood bag you have.
Grub Kanaya Human.
Noted.
May 4th, 8:45 a.m. Makara Gamzee Shifter.
Another miraculous event.
Makara Gamzee Shifter.
Anything I can do to help, Garbro?
Gray Cockat Troll.
Not at the moment.
Gray Cockat Troll.
For now, I'm just waiting for your vamp-safe blood.
Makara Gamzee Shifter.
Oh yeah, don't give her yours, it's toxic.
Makara Gamzee Shifter.
Dragon Seed might make her high. But it isn't very nutritious.
Gray Cockat Troll.
Of course you know which of your friends can get you high on their blood.
Gray Cockat Troll.
Thanks for the confirmation, though.
May 4th, 9:15 a.m. Grub Kanaya Human.
Friska is awake.
Grub Kanaya Human.
Do not come here.
Empora Aridin Siren.
Why the Hades not?
Grub Kanaya Human.
Her injuries are too much for her blood to fix alone.
Grub Kanaya Human.
I've contacted the hunter.
Grub Kanaya Human.
She is also overwhelmed. We do not want to startle her.
You.
Has she said how she escaped the Pharaoh?
You.
The woman never lets anything out from under her boot.
McCoy Terezi Dragon.
The witness is being incredibly evasive to that line of questioning.
McCoy Terezi Dragon.
I suspect she lacks capacity.
Aqueous walked back over to the bed, his strides urgent and not at all quiet. This changed things, and he needed Nepeta awake, needed to talk this out. It was too much for him to just wait for her to finally wake up. He reached down and gently shook her shoulder.
Nepeta, wake up, please.
He jostled her again, feeling the cords of muscle tense as she woke up. Her eyes shut open and she grinned at him, an excited purr in her throat.
Good morning,
she said cheerily, wriggling around and sitting up, stretching her arms in a big arc as she yawned. She noticed the peculiar expression on Aqueous's features immediately, scooching across the bed to get closer to him.
What's wrong? Is that expression something good or bad or surprising?
She cocked her head at him. Aqueous attempted a smile. His tumultuous energy made it feel forced.
Well, in many ways, all of those.
He reached up and fiddled with a strand of his hair.
Vrishchika showed up at Karkat's bridge. She's severely injured. Kanara's warned us all away so she doesn't get overwhelmed. A hunter is en route to provide aid.
Nepeta's eyes widened in shock, and she leapt up from the bed, snatching his phone from his hands to read the messages herself. Her large purple eyes darted across the screen as she took it all in.
Vriskus is alive. I didn't think it was possible. Didn't you tell me the Nevada territory is still a dead zone?
Nepeta looked up at Equius, her brow furrowed. He gently took the phone out of her clawed grip.
Yes, that is my understanding. We still haven't heard from those herds and the clan who lived there, and my father has heard nothing from the Pharaoh's spokeswoman. Total blackout. Nobody who goes in seems to come out.
Equius's tail swished with anxiety, and he felt the urge to pace. He needed to see her, needed to find out what she knew, needed to find out what she'd survived.
My father will want me to interrogate her.
Nepeta rolled her eyes, shaking her head at him.
You silly colt. You don't have to hide your worry behind your obligations. You can admit you want to see your oldest friend.
Equius frowned and tabbed out of the group chat, scrolling through his messages to find the communications with his father.
We were political allies before we were friends, and that obligation must be acknowledged. Father will want to know every detail. I'd better tell him she's alive.
He opened the correct chat and began texting a message, briskly explaining what little he knew. Nepeta stalked closer, craning her neck to read as he typed.
Fine, I suppose you can tell him that. But I don't understand what you think he's going to say.
The admission seemed to embarrass her slightly, but Equius didn't see it that way. It didn't matter to him that she wasn't soaked in politics like he was. She was lucky, in fact, to be free of all that.
The heart of the matter is that every single person who attempts to get anywhere close to the Pharaoh's pre-collapsed territory, they simply vanish. A teenager, her only living birth daughter, no less, to cross hundreds of miles through it, he snorted, shaking his head. Highly improbable. I would say impossible, were it not for the strong evidence to the contrary.
He thought of the last time he and Vriskus had met in person, before the Pharaoh decided to go full isolationist. How her mother's watchful eye had made the girl twitchy, how eager she was to retreat from the room as soon as the talks ended.
I admit she was not happy being in the palace.
You mean she was fucking miserable,
Nepeta said plainly. Seeming to delight in her vulgarity, Equius blushed, restating her words hesitantly.
Yes, she was deeply miserable.
The lock of hair he was worrying was starting to look like an abused paintbrush. He dropped it.
Carcat must be just as severely disquieted. He has previously asked me details on Rishchika's home situation. He was bent on rescuing her, but it seems her escape has put her in a terrible situation.
Perhaps you could check on him, since Vriskus is out of it, you know,
she said. Equius shook his head.
It is not my place. If the troll needs assistance, he will reach out to me.
He scraped the carpet with a hoof.
I need to lift something. I'll start on that sun porch. What is the nearest hardware store or lumber yard?
He went to his luggage, still packed at Nepeta's insistence to relax the night before, and retrieved a shirt. She murmured at this and launched herself onto his back. His legs didn't even buckle at the featherweight's impact, her arms wrapped over his shoulders.
We'll go over as soon as they say it's safe to. The store is towards downtown anyways. I'll show you where. We can get breakfast at Denny's.
She flopped backwards towards his hindquarters and stretched her arms out for his saddle pack, which was just out of her reach. He shifted slightly, allowing her to grab it, and she saddled him up. He had been shod in anticipation of the move to the city, but the impact of his legs on asphalt still took some getting used to. Traffic, fortunately, was much less of a problem after the catastrophe, and it wasn't uncommon to see a centaur or a werebeast on the newly freed up lanes of highways. Nepeta tugged another strand of hair away from his face. He wasn't quite sure what she was doing back there, but it felt like a braid that was crawling down his scalp. The rain had lightened up significantly, and the remaining mist was refreshing against the sweat gathering on his brow. Equius saw the outlines of the skyscrapers in the foggy distance. The city proper was still a way off when Nepeta tapped his bicep and pointed at an exit leading off the highway. He followed her directions to a strip mall across the road from some superstores, one of which was the welcoming orange facade of Home Depot. The glittering walls of power tools called to him from within, his one human vice. Every supposedly separatist alternative had one. Tinu Nepeta's was their books, specifically the cat ones, and Eridan's was fine clothes. Though he supposed both of them, and now himself, could hardly be called separatists anymore. Not needing to mask their very existence from the world, it did a lot to make them appreciate just what humanity had to offer. Speaking of, Nepeta drew his attention away from the hardware store and towards a gaudy building in the strip bearing the name Denny's.
"Come on, I'll get you a Grand Slam," she urged,
as he made his way over the median towards the restaurant. Equius considered.
"I do so enjoy the title of this Grand Slam. What is so grand about this slam, Nepeta?"
She chuckled mischievously.
"Oh, you'll see."
He could not see her where she was seated on his back, but he heard the smug smile in her voice. Whatever foolishness Nepeta planned to subject him to, Equius would endure it with grace and decorum, and would quietly cherish every mischievous giggle, every Cheshire grin. Seeing her happy like this, it was a soothing balm. No matter how warm he flushed with embarrassment. So he slowed to a halt to the parking lot, allowing her to dismount, then holding her hand as they walked towards the restaurant.
"A four-item breakfast does not meet my definition of grand," Equius stated plainly while they crossed the road to the hardware store. "The eggs were moist."
"Yeah, but you love moist. I'll bet your meow will change when you want breakfast at 3 a.m.
She stretched her arms over her head.
"That does not seem like the type of meal to keep until the middle of the night."
"Nope."
She hopped in front of his path, halting their progress. A car honked and changed lanes to get around them.
"That's the best part."
Her voice became conspiratorial.
"The restaurant is open 24 hours a day. No need to save your meals."
Equius staggered.
"The workers? They did not smell like vampires or poltergeists. How could their nature have evaded me?"
"They're human, Equius. Crazy humans that stay up all night and cook for you if you give them their stuff."
She produced a fistful of $100 bills.
"That's... Nepeta, where did you get that much money?"
Equius was about as divorced as she was from human society, but knew enough about how money worked from Vrischika's explanations and the diplomatic meetings, those and the drug deals between ignorant humans that frequently occurred in their territory.
"That's what Firescale asked, too."
Equius's raised brows invited further explanation. She giggled.
"Terezi. She said the same thing when I showed her."
She opened her backpack up. Inside were loose bills of no denomination smaller than 50. A few fluttered away in the breeze. She paid them no mind. Underneath the loose bills, he saw larger blocks of cash tightly bound in paper, like the kind delivered on pallets to banks.
"I always take a little when I go near the city. The humans really like it. It must be like catnip to them."
A few drops of sweat trickled down Equius's neck as he ushered her the rest of the way off the road and across the parking lot.
"Annie Whiskers, when the meteors fell and the water pushed me inland, I ended up in a really big house with tents all around it. That's where I found this money."
She picked at her claws.
"There were a lot of dead humans out in the front yard. They were all wearing white. You looked like they were having a party. There was even a stage and a microphone and stuff."
Her gaze got distant.
"There were little kits, too. There were cups all around them. It smelled like the nightberries."
Equius knew what she meant. He could see her taking steps between piled bodies, moving as quickly as she could towards shelter.
"In the basement, there was a big metal door that was open. I figured that it would be the safest spot. There was a dead guy in there, too. He had a little hole in his head. But I dragged it out so it wouldn't smell. I was alone there for a little while."
Her demeanor drooped, as most people's did when describing how they survived the catastrophe. And then she perked up as she continued.
"By then one day I saw Eridan flying by and I caught his attention. He was the one that told me how much humans like this stuff, and I was just using it as bedding. He seemed a lot more interested in the shiny yellow metal blocks, though. He said if I let him take the metal, he'd be able to get me a more comfortable place to live, and he did. So I guess I was pretty lucky, huh?"
She smiled at Equius. He made a mental note to have a talk with Eridan about this later. He'd been of the impression she acquired the 3-bedroom house from some sort of squatter's rights, not an outright purchase. His thoughts again drifted to the power tool aisle.
"Nepeta, would you be willing to use some of that to indulge a vice of mine?"
The corners of his lips tugged up.
"Heck yes. I want a grill, a big double one, and a lawnmower. The ones you can ride on that spin in one spot.
She raised a righteous fist.
Those moccasins will rue the day they tread their nasty little bellies on Lionstar's turf.
Equius pondered.
I suppose it would be feasible to rent a trunk and trailer.
He stopped mid-chin rub. Somehow his delight at simply being with Nepeta had distracted him from the mortal peril of his oldest ally. He flicked at his phone and checked the messages. Nothing yet. While he had his phone open, he sent a perfectly polite and perfunctory message to Aridin to inform them of the conversation they would be having at some point in the future.
CT.
We will be having words soon. You can expect me at your doorstep, Siren.
Aquius nodded at his own message. Aridin would appreciate him acknowledging the other alternative's proud heritage. Aridin. The Siren read the message and began frantically packing a go-bag. Aquius. Looking up from his phone, Aquius saw they'd arrived at the front of the Home Depot. Humans were giving them, mostly him, looks of awe and fear in equal measure. A few phones that forgot to turn their flash off blinked at him as they passed by. It was somewhat exciting, and he began sweating slightly. He was surely one of the first centaurs to move into human society. His kinsmen tended to fare quite well in their natural habitat. And what a specimen of centaurhood he was. The humans might be disappointed to see lesser of his kind after such a potent introduction. Nepeta grabbed a shopping cart and pushed it towards the sliding doors. He had to duck a little as he followed her into the building. The high metal ceilings were triumphant above the soaring shelves, and the smell of oil and sawdust was intoxicating. Equius's eye caught a sign advertising something new called the Pro Extra Loyalty Program. The sign promised discounts and reward points for frequent and professional customers. Equius was nothing if not professional and loyal. He thought of his plans to build accommodations for his and Nepeta's alternative features, maybe his other friends too, and the power tools. He realized that this trip would no doubt be the first of many.
Nepeta, I leave you to begin the hunt. I must apply for this rewards program now, to ensure its benefits are reaped for our transaction today.
Nepeta grinned and handed him a stack of money, which he placed in one of his bags next to the wallet Karkat had given him to hold his identification cards.
I'll be in the garden section. Catch up to me when you're finished, she said cheerily.
Then ran and jumped on her cart, careening towards the aisle that led to the greenhouse. Equius watched her nearly crash into another shopper, then carefully made his way to the nearest register. A fidgety teenage human stood at the register, bored, but the sound of metal horseshoes on concrete floors caught his attention. The employee's name tag read Greg, and Equius decided to take the initiative, thrusting out a hand to introduce himself. This human method of introduction, Kanaya had informed him, was the most respectful way to do so.
I am Equius of the Clan Zahak. I wish to gain entry into the Home Depot loyalty program. I am prepared to pay the price.
Cool. I'm Greg.
Greg hesitantly took the centaur's hand, then added on,
of the Home Depot.
Equius gave the employee a firm shake. The human's hand was withdrawn quickly, and he shook off a few droplets that hadn't previously been there before replying.
Yeah, we can sign you up. Let me just...
He ducked behind the register and shuffled something around, emerging with a clipboard with a blank form in one hand and a pen in the other.
Here, just write down your info and I'll punch it into the system. By the time you come back with your stuff, I'll have your rewards account ready for checkout.
Greg handed the clipboard and pen to Equius.
Would you also like to sign up for a store credit card today?
Equius squinted at the form, then asked.
A trusted friend informed me that credit cards are state-sponsored economic heroin needles, meant to keep the working-class customer distracted and isolated. Would you truly try to ply me with such narcotics, Greg of the Home Depot?
Karkat was truly wise in the ways of humans. Greg swallowed.
No, sir, we just have to ask.
Equius snorted, and he stepped away from the register to fill out the form. He started with the address, carefully penning the memorized street number of Nepeta's home. He paused. His home, their home, together. His tail started swishing as he continued walking. He studiously ignored one blank in particular, filling in phone numbers and other inane details, but eventually he could ignore it no longer. He sighed, pulling out his identification card. The photo was a bit embarrassing, with sweat tacking his hair to his forehead, clearly uncomfortable from having to kneel into frame, but Karkat had shown his own identification card, explaining they
always looked butt-fuck awful,
a profane if apt description. Karkat's head was barely in frame, and he seemed to be yelling at the person behind the camera the moment it was taken. Aqueous stepped out into the greenhouse, where Nepeta was astutely reading the name of each potted plant, moving between rows erratically. The real trouble was not his picture, but the size of the space for his legal name compared to the length of the name itself. After all, Aqueous was a nickname, an absurd portmanteau of his first and middle names that created a pun on equine and obscured the burdensome nobility of his full name. It was a gift from Nepeta, and he treasured it. His full name was a gift from his father and came with rank and responsibility. He had borne that burden and would continue to do so in professional life, but at least among his friends he could be Aqueous. Unfortunately, to reap the rewards of egregious power tool consumption, he had to make his full name fit an alignment to accommodate less illustrious ones. He painstakingly penned each letter, carefully using the space as economically as possible. Being meticulous was a point of pride, and he refused to let a silly human form defeat him. Even so, the final few letters were pinched at the end of the paper.
Epaphroditus, Quirinus, Supremus, Zahak,
stared back at him from the page. He wasn't quite sure how to feel about it. He would ask Rischika. She knew about responsibility as he did. He hoped he could see her soon.
Aqueous, they have catnip, I can smell it.
He saw Nepeta turn into a blur on all fours as she raced across the greenhouse.
Nepeta, cease this at once,
he bellowed, and awkwardly attempted to catch up to her through the narrow aisles. Beck. Your canine senses, amplified far beyond that of your mortal packmates, pick up on the disturbance far before they do. A low, deep, guttural howl, far less whined to the call than any living canine possesses. It is an ancient sound. One that makes the hair on your nape stand upright. You shoot to your paws, ears pricked, staring in the direction of that howl, the mountain whose foothills you rest on. The tone grows louder, and you feel it in your bones, the sound catching the attention of the world pack. They stop their various activities. Prey is abandoned. Friendly tussles come to a halt. Races unceremoniously paused. As the howl trails off, the ancient beast taking a breath somewhere out there, you give a sharp bark of attention. The world pack looks to you expectantly, their ears back, their postures hunched, their tails between their legs. It does not take much to convince them to leave you and Jade to make themselves scarce. You warn them not to wander too far afield and breathe in their collective scent so you can find them if they get lost in the strangeness of the fey night. You watch your packmates flee. Then turn towards the mountain, returning the howl with one of your own. You feel you are being watched, but you do not run, do not cower. To face the God-Eater, you must appear unruffled, and you force your fur to lay flat as the howl of the Empress of Magic sends shock waves through the ground, far closer than mere moments ago. She is flexing her power, scaring off the fairy fools before they think to play a trick on her. The beast that steps into the clearing is no dog, no modern wolf. It is large, far too large. While the top of your head reaches Jade's hips, this form of the Empress is a primordial creature and would reach Jade's chest if she could stand. Her fur is a strange, rippling pattern that changes each time you look, so you don't bother guessing. Instead, you wag your tail and woof a hello at the Empress as she approaches in her dire wolf form, and she wags her own tail in return. She chooses to greet you in the traditions of your people, licking your muzzle, and you return the gesture. She breaks off the greeting first, then looks from you to Jade, her massive head carefully lowering to sniff what remains of your best friend's wound.
It has been too long, Becquerel. What brings you so far from your territory? Who is the girl?
She backs away from Jade, sitting on her haunches. You sit as well and begin to explain.
The pup is my best friend, Jade Harley. Until recently, my primary territory had become an island where Jade lived. I was trying to protect her from the hot rocks. I knew they would destroy her island. So I took her on a metal bird box dropper. I thought it would take us to where Jade came from, before the island where she would be safe. But the hot rocks hit the box dropper, and Jade got hurt. We were too high up to see safe ground to jump from here to there to. So I took her through a rift into Ferry. But now she won't wake up.
You pause for a moment, then make your plea.
I really love her. Will you please help us?
The Empress is silent at first, and that silence makes you nervous. She is powerful and ancient. She is fire. To feed her, the humans destroy trees, hollow out mountains, tear up the earth. Power comes at a price. To heal a human girl just because you love her, the Empress must be calculating a steep one. The Empress stands, and once again approaches Jade, her loping gait full of intent.
I will heal her. Avert your gaze, old friend.
You smell ozone in the air and turn your head, squeezing your eyes shut as bright light floods through your lids. When the light fades, you turn and see a disoriented Jade beginning to stir. You want to go to her, but you need to finish this first. You bow to the Empress.
I thank you, Empress. What must I do to repay you?
You hope she will not ask you to serve her, to leave Jade and be her companion instead. You enjoyed your time with the Empress, but you could never leave Jade. She cocks her head, looking at you with confusion.
I seek nothing. Here
she pauses, struggling to explain why she would not demand payment from you, not follow her own customs. The answer she gives you seems hollow, a cover for her inability to find the truth.
It would not be right. There is no need to make you work for my favor. You have already shown loyalty unwavering. I grant this boon to you freely.
You are shocked by this gift, too shocked to thank her properly before her attention shifts. The direwolf flares her nostrils and sniffs the air.
But the world pack cannot remain here, and neither should the two of you. Call them to me.
The last of her words is phrased as a command, but you do not obey without thinking. First, you want to know why.
What would you do with the world pack, Empress?
You ask, curious.
What about the hot rocks?
This makes the Empress chuckle, a low roll of sound. She is not angry with your question, but her amusement is strange. Instead of replying directly, she presses her nose to your brow, and an image fills your mind. It is the world, and it is on fire, but then the fires cease. The craters in the ground fill with dark, sooty water. The darkness of destroyed human settlements begins to glow again. Somehow, as she shows you the world recovering, the saplings of new trees fighting to grow taller, you understand that time has passed, more time than you expected. 3 years there, mere days in Ferry.
The time of collapse has passed. Human and other are reunited. But there is an absence, a hole in the world, even if they can't feel it. Without you, Becquerel, without the love and loyalty of the dog, my people ache. I'm sure your people feel the same, without their friends and owners and human pups. Call them to me. I will take them home.
Satisfied by this, you do just that, opening your heart and your maw to sing a joyful call, to tell the world pack your pup will be okay, to tell them that it is time to go home. The world pack returns swiftly, sitting in eerily neat rows as they look up the hill at you and the massive hulking form of ancient power in your shadow.
Do not be afraid, my pack. She will send you to where you belong. Hold their scent in your heart and you will be with them.
The crowd yips and barks and howls in excitement, filling the air with a cacophony of happy hounds. One by one, the sound of each cuts off as the Empress works her magic. A flash of light and the crackle of ozone, a mark of where each dog had been. You watch the world pack disappear, slowly at first. Then faster and faster until each and every one, the uncountable masses of every dog alive, is sent to their owner. You wonder suddenly what happened to those whose companions were killed in the collapse.
Where did those without owners go? Most still have someone else. Someone who smelled close enough. Someone who loved the deceased as much as the dog did. Those dogs were sent there so they have someone new to love. Someone to share grief with.
The Empress speaks gently, talking about grief with the air of someone who suffered it herself.
Those who I could not find, Sushitan, I sent them to your head priestess, the Mayan girl who calls you Lord of Hounds. She already has three of your pack, and two lower priests in training. They have ample space to house a few more, until the lost decide where they want to be found.
You don't understand at first, but then remember the prayer, the promise. You can still feel her, you realize, feel faith and loyalty and belief. It is exciting, you think, for someone not of your pack to know you as the god you are.
This is a clever solution. I thank you for your wisdom.
You pause, considering your next move. You need to get Jade out of Faerie. Get her to the packmate of your old best friend. But you don't know where she is. You only know what the room looked like when she talked to Jade through the computer, teaching her human secrets.
Can you guide me to this place?
You send a mental image of your own, pressing your nose to her chest, unable to reach the direwolf's forehead. You picture a human woman, pale and cheery, standing in a strange room the color of grass. She is holding a glass in your memory, and her eyes are the color of flowers. Behind her, you remember seeing a strange, mutated cat, its extra eyes fixed on the woman. Other memories of this place, other videos of her, show different angles of the grass-colored room, of the flower-colored bed, of the scientific equipment she used to teach Jade. When you are satisfied you have given all you know, you step back.
I can take you to this location, but I cannot promise your quarry will be there, she warned. Human technology prevents me from knowing her. But yes, you and your companion will be sent there. Help her get up.
You turn away from the goddess, seeing Jade sitting up, looking around. She says your name is a question, and you bound over to her, nuzzling her affectionately. She laughs at your ministrations as you lick her face, sniff the place the wound was, and wag your tail in excitement. Jade is okay. She hugs you tight, then uses your shoulders to help get off the ground. She is happy to see you, but you can tell she doesn't know where she is. She checks her device, but the screen is dark. It is only when she looks up that she spots the direwolf, and she gasps in surprise. She doesn't seem frightened, which you think must be due to the Empress's magic.
We are ready, you say,
and grab Jade's sleeve in your mouth. The Empress nods, and you feel her power wrap itself around you both, a magic pure and deep and endless. In the blink of an eye, you and Jade are standing in the grassy room. Jade stumbles slightly, but you are there to brace her. She adjusts her glasses and takes in the scene. She opens her mouth, calling out, Dr. Lalonde?
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.